Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Pony Sync call for the 15th of March. Let's get to it. The first thing I want to look at is RFCs, like usual. And particularly, let's start with number 79, RFC for Bear FFI Lambdas, because I think there's general happy, positive agreement on this. Is anyone pretty happy with that? Can everybody hear me?
Yeah. Right. I think everyone here agrees that this is good.
All right, excellent. Coolio. I'm going to merge it then. Done. Merged. All right. The next one, which I think should also be a slam dunk, is number 81. This is the new promise methods that Theo's been working on. It's looking pretty swanky.
Yep, I think so.
All right, cool. Merge this too. Done. The next one is number 83, which is a small but very nice change in the persistent map API, which I think everyone's good with. All right, I'm going to merge this too. This is RFC merging day. There we go. And so that's the ones that are in final comment period. But I think there's some other stuff to cover. For example, number 82 is a fairly large syntax change for people, but and there hasn't been very much discussion on it. And I'm sort of wondering if that's because people are okay with it or if people haven't seen it.
I've looked over this and I like it.
All right, cool. Anyone else? Benoit, Gordon, thoughts?
Yeah, I like it too.
All right. That's... more positive than I expected for such a large change. And arguably, right, like I'm just sort of to be devil's advocate on something that I actually really rather like, we're introducing something that is purely to give call site information, right? There's nothing, the compiler doesn't need this at all. It's just to enforce call site visibility. But I like it. I'm a big fan of call site visibility. That's why I like the leading underscore for privacy, for example. So I'm quite interested in option two for this, to say do something question mark and here come the params. I think either is fine. Syntactically, I don't think it introduces any problems to move type definition question mark as well, so that the question mark then becomes right after the method name.
Yeah, so I mean the only downsides I see about that are that it's a larger, more, you know, it breaks more code to do that, obviously, if we go with the route of also moving the question mark in the parameter or in the method signature. And then also something that just came to mind is moving the question mark to be right after the identifier might kind of screw up Benoit's ongoing RFC that is about adding the checked exceptions.
Okay.
because I think it would kind of screw up that syntax. I don't know if you have any thoughts on it, Benoit.
Yeah, it could. Yeah, but I have to go back to that RSC2.
Right. Okay. Okay. Do you want to make a note of that on that on the RFC of that, because that's interesting.
Yeah, I'll add that comment here.
All right. Cool. I'm gonna throw this into final comment period because it seems like the discussion is mostly around specifics rather than is this in any way bad. It's more, hey, it's good. Let's figure out exactly how to do it, which means I think we're getting really close. Speaking of which, I've been talking with people inside Microsoft who worked on M#, the Midori language, and also I had a chance, I was on, I don't know if people know, I was on a panel down at QCon last week, which was a panel on the future of programming languages, which was me and Brian Goetz, who is the Java architect. He actually is responsible for all of Java, which is fairly heavy responsibility. And Joe Duffy, who was the lead on M# and Midori, who's now sadly left Microsoft, and one of the Elm guys, Richard Feldman, I think is his, I can't remember his last name, Richard. Sorry about that, Richard, if you ever hear this. And I got a chance to talk more about error handling stuff specifically with some of the Midori guys inside Microsoft. And I'm hoping to sort of bug Joe and waste some of his time on this too. The general feeling is that, first of all, the concept of errors which can never happen and therefore shouldn't be part of the type system, they should just cause the program to explode, is something I know we talked about this in terms of a capabilities thing before, and Joe specifically brought that up. They were quite keen on the fact that it's not a capabilities issue because it's a library design issue in the sense that it can't do something wrong. It can simply cause the entire program to cease working because if it is a library, the library is non-functional. It doesn't work. And there's no point in continuing. So the specific pony cases that we talked about before that exist on this, I think are still kind of interesting and something that we can consider. Things like in map, there are a couple unreachable, branches for example, insert has an unreachable branch. Now, it turns out that's no big deal for insert because it could error in other ways. Actually, no, it couldn't. If we could get rid of that, we could get rid of all errors in here, which is interesting. So insert could be non-partial if we followed this case. Similarly, insert if absent could be non-partial if we did this. Now, extremely controversially, they recommended that array indexing do the same thing, and that an out-of-bounds array index is actually a programming error and not something that ought to be partial. Which, wow, that's a pretty extreme philosophy, but it would lead to a lot of code that would otherwise be partial no longer being partial. What are you guys' thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know. It especially the latter seems very very contrary to some of the stated goals of Pony and the on the website, for example, like the thing about your program, will not crash. asterisk for running out of memory or other stuff like that.
Right. And as soon as we would say array indexing, oh, you got that wrong, so now it just explodes.
Yeah, it becomes quite easy to crash the program, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, it's trivial, right? Like, tiny any small error and you're a goner. So, yeah.
I personally have mostly a C++ background, and and the philosophy here is, for example, on array indexing. Well, it's not universal, but a lot of people and libraries do that. For example, on array indexing, yes, they consider it's a programming error, and we, for example, we assert or something like that. And I think regarding to ponies shouldn't crash, the way I view it, I think it should be more of if it crashes, you should see immediately what's the problem. Like, for example, if we remove the checks on the bound checks on array, we could it would be undefined behavior. We could crash. We could modify some memory or some other bad stuff. So if there were a crash, it would be hidden. The reason would be hidden.
Right.
But if we do some kind of assert, we can immediately see where the programmer can immediately see what the problem is.
Right.
So I personally wouldn't be opposed to that kind of change.
Interesting.
Because, yeah.
So one thing that this is making me think of is the discussion we had last week when we brought this up. We were talking about other languages. For example, we talked about Elixir having a sort of a convention of often having two functions that do the same thing, one of them has an exclamation point at the end. So if you do foo, if you do foo, it returns a tuple, and it either is like okay and your result, or it's error is the first element in the tuple, and then more information about the error is in the second tuple, second element of the tuple. Whereas if you call the bang version of that same function, you're calling it confidently, and it will raise an exception. With kind of the assumption being, under the Erlang Elixir let it crash philosophy, you're basically, usually you're raising that exception with the thought that it's going to crash your program. And so calling a function with bang on it is like a way of, being confident, like, you're confidently invoking the function in a way that says, if there is an error from this, I just want it to crash my program. Or, in Elixir, it could technically be caught somewhere further up the chain. But if we ignore that part of the convention and just say, that if we had some way, for example, if we're going back to the idea of call site visibility as well, if we had some way to invoke a function that could error, but in a confident way, saying that this will, you're invoking it and saying this will never error, then it becomes the caller's choice whether they want that to be a partial call or they want it to be an abandonment, a possible abandonment call. So like, for example, we could leave insert as being Or rather, like, the convention would be in a library, you don't use abandonment. And maybe we would even do something similar, like we do for FFI, saying, like, this library cannot use abandonment. But then in the application, when you're calling stuff, you can make a choice to say, I'm going to like call this confidently. And if there is an error, it will crash my program with an assert like, message that tells me where it crashed. And the resulting, result is not partial. The body of the function that you call it from is not partial because you're just abandoning if anything went wrong.
Right. That's interesting.
And so maybe if we talk about both of these changes together, we could talk about the, you know, maybe use a question mark to invoke it in a way that could cause an error to bubble up, or you use an exclamation point to invoke a partial function in a way that causes abandonment if it fails.
Right. Yeah, that's very interesting.
And then also we probably need some kind of compiler intrinsic keyword or something that would just cause an abandonment like in a branch, right? If you're saying, right, if this is ever this, then abandon.
Yeah. Yeah. I think something like an unreachable keyword that,
right,
like that. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's interesting. And it could even be a some kind of invocation keyword for so there, it's the call site that decides whether this is an abandonment or not, basically.
Yeah, I mean that's what I'm kind of proposing in this idea, because I think it makes it so that your API is more flexible, and you don't have to have like an abandonment version and a partial version of the same function. You both, or you know, it's depend, like, I don't know. It kind of seems like something that should be up to the caller whether they want to crash the program or not, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Where they say, hey, look, this really isn't ever going to happen. So then what about nesting? So thinking about it as a nesting issue, if we adopted that approach, a specific example, map.pony, just because I happen to know it's there. If we look at insert and it's unreachable branch, it occurs because of lines 136 and 147, where we're doing array indexing, but we actually already have the array index because we looked it up on line 134, right? We're just reusing, right, something that we already found. These things are absolutely, under no circumstances, out of bounds. And so there, it could be that map.pony is calling these things as a, I promise this isn't out of bounds, but then anyone calling insert wouldn't have the option of calling it as a partial function because it isn't, right?
Right. Yeah. And that's why I said it would be the convention, you know, under this scheme, it would be the convention to not use abandonment in library code, under the assumption that a user would have the option to like whitelist like they do for FFI and say these packages are allowed to do abandonment. You know, so it's not really infecting the signatures of any of the methods. It's just something you choose to do at the application level when you feel like being a little bit, I don't know, reckless. But it would be frowned upon to be reckless in a in a library.
Interesting.
So insert, in this case, you know, under what I'm proposing, insert would look the same way, but you would be able to invoke it in a way that says, okay, I know this is going to succeed, and I know that this doesn't really address the problem that insert isn't really conceptually a partial function at all.
Yeah, it will never raise an error ever.
Right. Right, and that is something that, yeah. I mean, it never, and I guess we could say it never raises an error ever as long as the logic is correct, right?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, like as long as we didn't do like I plus one somewhere.
Indeed.
I don't know. Yeah.
I mean, down the road, this exact sort of thing is something that I'm very interested in a research sense, in terms of using a combination of dependent types or other kinds of reasoning to be able to prove that index is in bounds on the array, so that we know that search returns an index such that it is in bounds on the array and the array size hasn't changed when we use that index. But that's not going to happen anytime soon, if ever, right? There are languages that can prove those things, but currently the technology around that can make them very difficult for the programmer to use, actually. Yeah, okay. I think this needs more discussion, more thought, if we are ever to go down this route. But I think it's interesting what you're talking about there.
Yeah, I mean, like the main thing that I would like to preserve is the ability to be, you know, because right now you can say with Pony, your program's not going to crash, you know, asterisk.
Yeah. FFI.
the asterisk is FFI, but you can whitelist packages, and this would be another asterisk in a very similar way, but you could also whitelist packages.
Right.
I'd like to kind of preserve that if possible, but
I see your point very much.
I think this map insert is, you know, like this is a fairly simple example of an unreachable thing, but if you think about, for example, moving toward a future of, you know, maybe having the Pony compiler being written in Pony, which I am trying to move toward. There's a ton of places where we use assert in the compiler, and a lot of them could be cleared up, you know, just through type safety.
Absolutely.
But some of them would not, right? You're making assumptions that the previous pass did things that it was supposed to have done, and some of that could be taken care of with the type system. Some of it can't, and so. I imagine there being lots of use of this sort of unreachable paradigm, whether it's a language construct or whether it's what Sean and I are currently doing separately, is like, you know, using a calling FFI abort and printing.
Right.
FFI exit and printing a message. But whether it's that or that, like you come up with very complex cases where like you're kind of assuming the whole program is working correctly, rather than in this map case where it's fairly simple to kind of prove to yourself that this is going to be true.
Yeah,
it's going to be truly unreachable. Whereas in the compiler, there's going to be lots of places where it's a lot harder for you to get it all in your head at once and prove that to yourself.
And yet at the same time, the compiler should absolutely not continue, right? There's no recovery. We're done here.
Right. And I feel like that's a decision that can be made because the compiler is an application rather than a library.
Yeah.
That's why I like the convention of forcing, you know, at least, you know, conventionally forcing libraries to not use abandonment, and applications can use it when they need to because they know, hey, I know I can crash at this point because I know what my application semantics are and when I can't continue and when I can.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Anyway.
Yeah. And yet, one last thing, and then we should probably go on to other stuff. But I also feel that there's the inverse of this, which is functions where you don't want the caller to be able to say, this is never going to raise an error, because that's not appropriate for that function.
Give me an example.
Yeah, it's a good point. If there isn't a good example.
Well, I mean, we can think about it more.
Okay. All right. Cool. So next thing to cover, RFC number 80, initial CLI format RFC draft. It seems like we've got some pretty good general agreement here. I'd like to move this to final comment. I'm almost like ready to just put it on a vote. But maybe we should just leave it in final comment for a little bit. But it basically, it looks really good. People's general impression?
Yeah, I think it looks good, but I'd like to see, like I was saying before, a little bit more detail in the RFC about the API that that's used within the program, and also there's still the kind of outstanding question of whether this should replace the options package, this should just become the new options package, or if the options package should be like deprecated softly in some way, or if we to keep them both as separate packages.
I'm really for killing the existing one and using this one and not necessarily calling it options. I think options is not the best name. CLI, I think, is a much better name, actually, although it's an abbreviation and that's not great, but it's a pretty well-understood abbreviation. I think we're early enough. We're still doing the occasional syntax change, right? So I think just killing a package is fine. Yeah. Okay. So we'll leave it on final comment and that way we can add a little bit more if we need to. Okay. Number 84, arrays as sequences. General response seems to be positive. Have other people had a chance to look at it? No? Okay. Have a look. I'm tempted to throw this into final comment period as well, as there's seems to be general sort of so far approval. Is that all right? Should we put it in final comment?
Yeah, period? I think that's appropriate.
All right, cool. So if you have a look at, if anyone's interested in terms of how does this impact the code, if you look at the implementation branch that is linked to, you can diff that against master and see the actual changes in the standard library. Mostly, the changes are all in test cases because that seems to be where array literals are used a ton. And in the test cases, it's, gosh, we seem to have changed a comma into a semicolon. Not that big a deal. But then there are other places. There's a couple other places where it was lists of stuff that goes across multiple lines, and all of a sudden you don't need any separator at all. And that, for me, I know it's a small thing, but boy, I really like that. And of course, there's the issue of what does the operator mean? What does the comma operator mean as opposed to the semicolon operator, which I think is worth thinking about. Anyway, I think that covers RFCs. Does anyone have any other RFCs they want to cover? All right, cool. In that case, PRs. There's a couple of these marked needs discussion. So number 1644, buffered reader append. So Joe, you marked this as needs discussion. Is that over returning an array U8?
Yeah, basically if we want to make these two be consistent with each other, reader and writer, There's kind of two ways to do it. One is to make it to, like I did in this PR, make it so that reader accepts any ByteSeq. The other would be to make it so that writer always puts out an array of array U8 instead of an array of ByteSeq. One thing that I like a little bit better about this, the version that's implemented in the PR, is that you don't incur that, like, you're possibly incurring less cost by only paying it at the reader end. If you have a string versus an array, right? Array UA, you're paying the cost at the reader end. Whereas on buffer.writer, I think there was a method to add a string.
Yeah, write and write v can both take strings or array U8s.
Right. Right. And so you would be paying the cost in the writer anytime you use strings.
Yeah.
Which is not a huge cost because it's reusing the underlying pointer.
Yep.
But it's still swapping out the array object for a string object.
Right, so you're still doing an allocation. Whereas the change here, where we're appending an arbitrary byte seek, if it is an array U8, if it happens to be an array U8, then the only thing we've paid is a comparison operator on the V table, right? That's the only thing that cost we've paid. And if it's a string, then we pay the cost, but only if it's a string.
Yeah.
And the most common case for reader is going to be network data, right? On average. Because if it were file data, you could have done this directly from file and you didn't need reader. Which will come across as an array U8, and then we're essentially not paying any cost, right? That VTable check is and comparison, right, is going to get branch predicted and pipelined very often into nothing. So I prefer this way.
Okay. Benoit, do you have anything else to say about this? And I think you brought up the idea in the last call.
My initial idea was to return an array of array U8 instead of an array of ByteSeq to return a concrete type and potentially avoid some calls through the VTable. So I think last week, I think it was Andy that said that when he implemented the class with you, Sylvain, he asked you that specific question if a writer should return an array of array. And apparently you said that since writer is intended to be used with a TCP connection, TCP connections takes arrays of ByteSeq, it wouldn't be important. So what do you think about that?
That's interesting. Yeah. And that's true. And it specifically does take arrays. In the sense that the TCP connection on it's basically all about write and write V, right? Where write takes a byte seek and right V takes a byte seek iter. Now, in the particular, yeah, TCP connection will go through the V table more than likely to pick up the pointer out of the bytes, because yeah, it's likely to go through. Indirect branch prediction might make that go away, but boy, that would have to be measured to be sure. Excuse me. Sorry, coughing fit. But that is interesting. That is the primary use, right? Is for buffered reading and writing TCP connections. Essentially, it's a packet assembler. The other nice thing about for writer is that you do want to be able to send it strings, because that's a really common case, right? Is to be pushing strings into a packet. Yeah, I would still lean towards array byte seek unless we could measure a real performance benefit out of having a concrete type.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Sorry, I was waffling quite a bit there because your idea of being able to do that with a concrete type is compelling, right? Like anytime we can do that is always, always nice.
Maybe we could do something with covariant generics, in the sense that if the type is immutable, I think covariant generics would be safe. But there is complications with box type, but. Maybe I'm completely wrong, but couldn't we allow covariant generics on immutable types, and that would solve the problem, I think.
Such that an array U8 is in fact a subtype of array byte seek.
Yeah, but only if it's val.
That's very interesting. Because once you're immutable, is there any situation where the type parameter would be contravariant? That's very interesting. I had not thought of this. This is super interesting.
Yeah, well, and also we have to think about it not just for array, but for any generic type you could possibly write, right?
Right, exactly.
You know, like, is it possible to write a generic type that that screws up that rule?
It is.
And
it is possible.
It is.
Yeah, because you can have a generic type with a fun val on it, and it's generic over A, and in that fun val. Oh, no, wait a minute. No, that's on the way in. Yeah, because in that fun val, all of a sudden you could pass it in something that was less specific. So if you had any fun val that took its type param A as an argument, if you treated them as covariant, you could have a less specific type there.
Yeah, so maybe we could do something with not allowing that kind of parameters. Maybe that would be too restrictive. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's awfully restrictive. For example, if you check out set.pony.
I'll open the file.
The apply function on line 30 is pretty straightforward. So for an immutable set, couldn't write the apply function. And in fact, even contains would be problematic because contains value, and all of a sudden, because it could be a super type, it might not actually be hashable with H. In fact, because it could be a super type, it could simply be a non-hashable type that you passed to contains or apply.
Yeah.
Okay. So that was super interesting while it lasted.
So one thing I would say in general is that I would still kind of like to just get rid of ByteSeq eventually and have string be like a way of interacting with an array of bytes rather than having string be necessarily its own like kind of copy of those bytes. But yeah.
I think that's interesting. In the sense that
possibly the string would contain the array you ate, and then you wouldn't need an extra allocation to convert.
Oh, I see. So it's got an embedded array you ate.
Well, I kind of have two ideas I keep going back and forth with. One of them with it being an embedded array you ate, and the other with it being like strings being a primitive, and you would use it for interacting with array you ate as if they had a particular encoding.
Uh-huh. That's interesting. The other thing is with the specialization stuff that we were talking about, all of the string methods could be made available on an array only when A is U8.
Yeah, that's true. Or, you know, for that matter, with specialization, that also just solves this immediate problem too, because you can do a special implementation when it is an array of array U8 rather than array.
Yep.
Yeah. I think that solves this direct problem too with talking about wanting to use concrete types.
Oh, you're right.
When you want to, because you can use that trick for the concrete type.
Huh.
But that's only if it's known to the caller, I guess.
Yeah, because you're going to have to figure it out. It can't be runtime. We've got to do it statically.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
But still, yeah, I don't know. I'd kind of like to get rid of ByteSeq if possible and make it so that array U8 is the canonical way to represent. Whether it's the kind of thing I was talking about or the thing you just said where you could make string methods available on array. I'm not necessarily sure I like that, but anyway.
I mean, ideally, it would be really nice if the definition of string was type string is array U8.
Right.
And it just worked. That would be lovely.
Yeah, or, I mean, the other thing, if you had a, I know this is not a road that you particularly want to go down, but if string were a subclass of array U8, right, where you could, but maybe with a restriction, so you don't have to deal with the field problem, and maybe you'd have the restriction that you couldn't define fields on a subclass. You could only define extra methods.
Interesting.
Like just a way of extending an existing type with more methods that do extra things. Or just being able to define type methods like on a type alias and having that type alias be like kind of its own concrete type.
Where it's one of these with these additional functions, so it has an extended vtable, but it is still one of those.
And maybe that fits in with the new type thing that we've talked about before, like the Haskell new type. Where you're saying this is distinct, and it also has these extra methods.
Yeah, that would complicate pattern matching a little bit.
Oh, yeah, and I guess if you're saying it's distinct, then...
then it isn't the same type.
Yeah, right. So that makes it not useful for the original problem we were talking about. But
they are separate. They're still. It's still possible to have the original one, right? If you had type string is array U8, and it has these methods on it, which the grammar, by the way, allows right now, right? You're going to get later errors, but the definition of the grammar says, of course you can put, it's members, class definition, yeah, like anything else, slap your members right on it, which is, you know, not true. But having members on a type definition is interesting.
Yeah, so then I guess at the place where you wanted to use it, you would, you know, for example, if you got a parameter that was an array U8, and you say, okay, I want to start treating this like a string here, you know, you do like let s colon string equals my array or whatever. And the type system would know that you can grab an array U8 and assign it to a reference that has type string.
Yeah, you couldn't. That's interesting. You couldn't.
Well, not with type aliases as they exist now. Like, this would be, type aliases would become like a concrete entity.
Yeah, but you couldn't. Because you'd have to replace the descriptor.
Oh. Well,
you would have modified the type in the object.
Yeah, well, when you talk about it complicating pattern matching, maybe they don't have a separate, maybe they don't have a distinct descriptor. Maybe they match as the same, but if your reference happens to have this type, you get to use the extra methods. If it doesn't, then you don't get to use them.
Oof. Right.
I don't know if
you actually add the method, but you actually add the methods to the base type. In terms of the concrete, in terms of code gen time.
Yeah, they would need to be added to the. Yeah, like in this example, it would be basically the same as if we did the thing you were saying, where like, if array U8, sorry, if A in array is U8, then add these extra methods. But instead of defining them in the array.pony file, which I kind of feel like is a little bit dirty.
Yeah, it is.
You'd be defining them in a separate file. And also it would be giving programmers the opportunity, you know, you could extend array U8 with your own methods in another package.
Yep.
And if the user, you know, included your package, then they would be code gen onto array U8, but you could only use them if you were interacting with it as if it had this, your special type that was in the type system.
Right.
But at code gen, yeah, they'd have to all be there. Yeah.
Interestingly, what it wouldn't do is infect all instances of array U8. I mean, it would under the hood, right? But not in a way that matters to the programmer, right? It's got, takes up some vtable slots. That's no big deal.
Yeah, and you'd have to mangle the code gen's names so that if two different types, if two different type definitions extended the same concrete type with different methods that had the same name, you wouldn't want those to conflict with each other in the vtable. So you need to have like,
ooh, no, you can't. You go. You ha- no, they couldn't. You'd have, that would have to be an error. That's,
well, interesting. Couldn't you do extra mangling?
On the, no, name? Because yeah, of structural type dispatch.
Okay.
So that if one of those fulfilled a structural type, the structural type would be expecting to find it at a constant index.
Mm.
And that's even true with perfect hashing, right? It expects it to find it at a constant index modulo,
okay,
the size.
So it would have to be a compiler error, and it would say, you know, these two methods that extend the same base type have different signatures. Or rather, they conflict with each other at the name level.
Yeah. Yeah. Because even if they had the same signature, still no good, right? Which one gets called? Yeah. But that's a really interesting idea, because that gives type extension. I mean, it's extension methods, right? In the same way that, say, C# has extension methods.
Yeah. And then I guess, I don't know, rewinding a bit to the other sort of idea we were talking about originally, where it was sort of like a subclass. I mean, the alternative would be when you take a, No, you couldn't do that for Valentine. Never mind. I was about to say that if you wanted to, you know, convert, like let's say array U8 and string are distinct types that have different type of descriptors, and you wanted to convert from one to the other, you would just, you know, the underlying code gen would change the type descriptor at the time you did that, but then that would break for things like val or tag where they're being accessed possibly concurrently. Right.
Yeah. Exactly.
The types for yeah. Unless you did like a copy on modifier, nah. Then you're allocating again. You haven't solved anything.
Yeah. Oh, this is. But going back to the kind of sort of extension method-ish sort of thing, that would let you do units. For example, you could say type meter of, you know, of some real number. Is that real number with the additional methods of 2 feet equals this times, you know, 1/0.3048 or whatever the heck the number is, I can't remember, etc. And when it was meters, this is problematic because any number, if you pattern match to determine if it was meters, it would say yes.
Yeah, and also, like, if you can just softly convert, you know, just by assignment, that means that you can possibly, you know, it doesn't give you the type safety of not being able to pass in feet where meters are expected.
Right. What if you're saying it's not a coerced type, you're not saying it's coerced. You're not saying. Oh, I see. If you're saying that it expects me. Oh, I see what you mean. Right. So if you say any array U8 is a string, then yeah.
Yeah, it doesn't give you the type system benefits of actually thinking about them as being distinct.
We could have sugar that says you have to explicitly you could provide a method that is how to construct one of these things. It doesn't construct anything, right? It's a no-op at runtime. And so string could allow array U8 to become string.
Yeah, or possibly you would have to use as, right? We already have the as keyword. Yeah. It could just be an as that was not partial.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Anyway, we should probably get back to other
people. Right, okay. This is extremely interesting, though. Okay, I think for 1644, I'm going to take off... No, I'm not going to have to take off labels, because I think we should just merge it, right?
I think so.
Okay, let's merge it. Excellent. Yes, we are running out of time. We're running out of time. It looks like is the change that says arch equals x86-64, and we should merge that right away. Okay, merging. I don't think we have time to cover issues. Are there any of these PRs that we should talk about straight away?
I'd like to cover 1677 really quick.
Excellent.
So, the CI failed on OS X LLVM 3.9, but that's because of
homebrew. Yes, exactly.
And this PR fixes the memory allocation issue on Windows with JIT tests. So Well, it's a quite complicated change. So maybe if you could review it later.
Sure.
Later this week or.
Okay. Yeah. Absolutely. So what's the gist of the change? What was the core idea?
Well, the problem was that there was a data race in the previous algorithm, where if there was a concurrent modification, we could lose some of the nodes, and they would nothing would be pointing to them anymore. So. Right. So it wasn't fixing the problem.
Right.
So I changed the algorithm with but this one is using some kind of node acquiring. So we acquire a node and the previous node of the position where we're going to modify. So I don't think it's less performant than the other incorrect one.
Okay.
But yeah.
Okay, cool. Yeah, I'll go through this. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right. That's our time limit. Is there anything that we should cover, even though we've hit our time limit? All right, cool. I seem to feel like this every week, but this was a particularly good session. Thanks, everybody. Cool. See everybody soon. Bye.